Stan Ball on WEEI.
Yeah, it's just trying to make sure that we're supporting Drake and supporting the football team. And again, this is a highly competitive, confident receiver that's produced throughout his career in multiple ways. Play style, right? He's got a play strength to him, right? That you see that he can play physical, you know, route craft, good at the catch point. He's been good in the red zone. It's just his conversation, his demeanor, his attitude, and his presence have been, you know, great through our conversations, and you know, hopefully we can continue to add good players.
Those were the dulcet tones of Patriots head coach Mike Vrabel welcoming us into the 12 o'clock hour here on WEEI. Thanks for being with us. Special thank you to Justin Turpin of WEEI and WEEI.com for talking some Celtics. We'll begin the Patriots conversation in just a moment, but before that, we're going to go back to the phones. John is in the car. Good afternoon, John. How are you?
What's up? Pretty good. What's up, Dan? You know, I listened to Turpin and listened to all the stuff this week about, again, new arena with the ownership.
Yeah.
I keep pushing back and pushing back. I think people forget, like, the Bruins ultimately, like, that Delaware North thing, like, they're a popcorn company, but, like, they're a pretty big popcorn company that owns right. And operates, like, a lot of venues throughout the world.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're going to, like, sell off the Garden, but to the Celtics anytime soon, but I got to imagine like that lease that they have with the Celtics must be pretty good because for both parties, because ultimately, yeah, the Bruins don't want another 20,000 seat venue in the city of Boston to like cut down on all their concerts that they're given that they have and all the stuff they have. So I have to imagine whatever lease they have with the Celtics is going to be primo for both parties in terms of, the Celtics don't necessarily need a venue to play in. They'd like to have probably a lot more opportunity around the Garden, but I got to imagine they're not paying a ton and or they're not giving up a ton to play there for what they got.
Yeah, absolutely, John. Thank you for the call. And I think that that's a point well taken. And I think it also furthers that conversation with the new ownership group that's coming in, where you just had your new owner and Bill Chisholm wave $6 billion in front of your face and go, well, this is what I'm capable of. This is the kind of spending that I can withstand. There's nothing stopping me from pursuing this new arena, which would probably get both sides back to a negotiation table in the years to come when this lease ends up expiring. But I think it's a fair point when you talk about the perspective of the Jacobs family, because if, say, for example, you lose the Celtics as a tenant and they are building something new that opens up in 2035 or whatever it ends up being, all of a sudden now TD Garden is the outdated and antiquated building in the city of Boston. And all of a sudden you have two choices if you're a major comedy act or a band or, you know, a traveling road show of some sort that uses the Garden facilities outside of Bruins and Celtics games. Now you have a decision to make. Am I going to the brand spanking new, probably pretty sick arena? I'm not saying it's going to get to the point of the Clippers new building, the Intuit Dome or whatever it's called, where, you know, the different intricacies and the different details are just out of this world, expensive, exorbitant. But it's going to be state of the art. And not to say that TD Garden is not, but there's a big difference between something built in the 90s and something that was built in 2035. So it's a point well taken. And both sides, given how competitive they've been and how many playoff dates they've gotten and how often both sides have competed for championships, have probably profited and made a lot of money and a lot out of this partnership that's gone on for the entire length of the life of the TD Garden, going back to the TD Bank North Garden, to the Fleet Center and whatever else. So I think it's more and that was, and I want to make sure that I highlight that Terp also quantified his idea as that's more of a pipe dream. It's an idea that's been floated around. He didn't say that it's reality, and I don't think it is, but it's a fascinating conversation. And it was also complimented by the 508 781 on the text line. I love the idea about buying the Bruins in the Garden from the Jacobs brothers, but there's no way in Hades that's happening, is the way that it was phrased on the text line. So a point well taken there, and John, thank you for the call. To the Patriots we go, with Mike Vrabel speaking about Stephon Diggs, and then Stephon Diggs speaking to the media earlier on this week. A couple of cuts that I wanted to grab from his opening press conference, beginning with the the relationship between Mike Vrabel and Drake May and the draw between the head coach and the quarterback that that Diggs saw when he was going through his free agency process, because the conversation around Diggs up to this point, when he was a potential free agent target of the New England Patriots, was, well, what about the mindset? Is he a diva? Is he a headache? Is he going to be a problem? Look at how it ended in Minnesota. Look at how it ended in Buffalo. And that was the worry from people who were naysayers about this move. And so Stephon Diggs addressed what the draws were for him coming to New England. And I feel like the two kind of relate.
Seeing that I got the experience, you know, I've been doing this for 10 and a half years. Always at the half now, but I play with a lot of quarterbacks. I've been around a lot of quarterbacks. So learning the quarterback, getting to know him, spending more time with him. Once you know somebody on a more personal level, I feel like it's a lot of carryover to the field, whether they're risk takers or like to play aggressive, like to play smart, and just honing in on what he's good at. You know, we played him last year. He shows a lot of fight. He got that fiery quarterback, I want to win mindset. So, you know, that's something that I get excited about and love to be around. But as far as, like, his development as a quarterback, I feel like, you know, that's not really too much of my job. My job is to get up and catch the ball. So I just look forward to getting back out there and, you know, being one of the weapons for him.
I mean, That certainly would have been a draw. If I was a wide receiver who was looking to partner with a quarterback, and not for nothing, but a quarterback that kind of comes from the ilk of a Josh Allen, for example, a quarterback that gave me a great deal of success and who I partnered with for most of my tenure in Buffalo in a happy nature. So that was Diggs speaking about Drake May. And you also have to imagine looking at the opportunity to be a wide receiver one in this league. Not to say that he is in the Jamar Chase, Justin Jefferson by any means. He's not relatively close to that kind of true number one X receiver in the National Football League. But compared to what the Patriots have, he is far and away the Patriots wide receiver one. And the one thing that led to the divorce in Buffalo that people highlighted that I think is worth noting is he had his targets taken away. When Ken Dorsey was fired and Joe Brady was promoted to the offensive coordinator of the Buffalo Bills, he almost immediately implemented a change in how the Bills were looking at the target share in their wide receiving group, to where there was no longer a wide receiver one, wide receiver two. It wasn't Diggs getting the lion's share of the targets and then Gabe Davis and then trickling down to the rest of your receivers. No, it was, we are going to spotlight whoever is designed to be open on this play. We're going to ride the hot hand and we're going to spread the ball around. And it led to some very low, comparatively speaking, performances in the back half of that season after Brady was brought in. He went from averaging probably nearly 100 yards a game to games in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s in terms of receiving yards. And that's what kind of built up the frustration and led to the eventual relatively messy divorce between he and the Buffalo Bills. That is not going to be a problem with the New England Patriots. And I would have to imagine that that's a big draw. That's a draw for both sides. You know that in the short term, you need somebody who is reliable for Drake May to get the ball out to. And you know that Diggs has had a great deal of success as a high-volume receiver. He was seventh in the NFL in receptions when he tore his ACL last year. So the one thing that jumps out that I would imagine is a draw on both sides is this guy has a track record of the more that you feed him the ball, the happier he is, and usually the more productive he is going to be. So Diggs sees the opportunity to get a target share that he believes he is due and still capable of handling, and the Patriots see a guy who, compared to the options that were left on the table, is probably the most reliable, and I would guess has the highest upside. And I say that with a question mark at the end of the sentence, because, again, this is a guy at 31 years old that is coming off of a devastating lower body injury. When you talk about a wide receiver that needs to cut quickly, that needs to, you know, needs to change direction on a dime, that needs to be explosive, that needs to be able to win one-on-one battles, get inside, get outside, all of that is generated through the lower body, and he just had a devastating injury, especially for a guy with the kind of hard miles on his legs and on his body that Stephon Diggs has, for a guy that's been in the league for the better part of a decade. So that's going to be a concern until it's not. And I know he addressed I'm ahead of schedule. I'm recovering. I'm recovering at a rate that maybe he wasn't even expecting. And I get all that, but I'm not going to believe it until I see it. And I'm not going to believe it until I see it for a bigger sample size than just week one. Last year, we saw the Patriots in week one, and everybody thought, oh, Gerard Mayo's the savior. Look at this Jacoby Brissett guy turning back the clock. And here we are now. So, again, you're going to need to see it for an extended period of time before I'm willing to believe anything. But out of the options that were available, this was the best. If my option was Keenan Allen, who cannot keep himself on the field to save his life, in a multi-year snapshot, Tyler Lockett, who had career lows in receiving yards and touchdowns. He had his lowest number since 2017, and he played like half that season. So he's smoked. Allen's extremely inconsistent. Amari Cooper, the reports around the league, all right, he's physically done as well. He was not really a factor with Buffalo. They acquired him at the deadline, and he was not a factor last year. So why not go to the guy who, yes, despite having the kind of injury that can really mark the end of the end of elite productivity in a career of a wide receiver, was still elite from an NFL perspective up until that point. Top 10 wide receiver? No. Top 20? We're at least starting to have that conversation. You're not seventh in the NFL in receptions and second on the Houston Texans in receiving yards by accident. That's something that suggests that you're still among the league's better players at that position if you're that reliable. So I'm cautiously optimistic. You made the best decision that you could given what was available to you. And now I wonder what's next. Because I still, I don't know. I don't know if you're done. Are you going into the season with a question mark of Stephon Diggs being ready and fully explosive come week one, and then your options are literally the exact same options you had last year except for Mac Hollins? I don't know. You've been so aggressive adding on all levels of your defense, something that Mike Vrabel acknowledged in the weekly piece put out by Mike Reese on ESPN, talking about how aggressive they've been, adding on all levels of the defense, whatever else. You've been aggressive. You've led the league in free agency spending by a comfortable margin. You're up over $300 million spent in free agency, all told. Are you really done? Because in my estimation, you're still missing a wide receiver too, and you still have done nothing to address the left tackle position. So you very much still record an incomplete grade from me in this free agency. Defensively, unequivocally better. And you've gone through a cleaning of house to where this team is going to be faster. They're going to be more aggressive. They're going to play more of a 2025 style of defense. And I think that they've done a tremendous job in modernizing their defense on the fly and flushing out some of the character issues that you may have had last year. So that's all fine and good. And I think that if there is a coach and coordinator duo that can work with Stephon Diggs to avoid any of the headaches that have come in his past stops, I think this group can do it. And Diggs acknowledged how much of a draw playing for Mike Vrabel was when he spoke to the media a couple days ago. So it's clear that those two, at least for the time being, are on the same page. That's what we said every single time that Stephon Diggs got to a new team. But for the time being, the new car smell is still fully there. But I still acknowledge, and I think they would do the same, that you're not done. So how does that manifest itself? Does it look like one of the names that was mentioned prior? Are you then putting a guy like a Tyler Lockett behind a Stephon Diggs? All right, fine. If you do it for a year, is it going to kill you? No. Does it make you better from where you are? Yeah. Yeah, it does. Or are you waiting for the San Francisco 49ers to have to pay out a bonus on April 1st to Brandon Ayuk? And then would you re-engage in that conversation with the draft capital that you have and the money that you still have to spend?
It sounds like if they pay out that bonus that they're just going to keep them.
Okay, I mean, that makes sense. If you're going to commit that much financially, then that's all fine and good. So, Zach, let me ask you, knowing that that bonus is there, because it's a relatively hefty bonus, but you still have a league-leading amount of cap space to work with, would you make that deal? Would you throw a seventh-round pick at them? Something just to allow them to get him off the books?
I would, yeah, but it kind of depends on their evaluation of Travis Hunter or Tet McMillan. Like, if you think that they can give you a Brandon Ayuk level of production on a five-year rookie deal, then I lean that way. But if you're thinking trade back Will Campbell, what's his name, Membu from Missouri, another tackle, like, if you're going to go the offensive line route, then I would pay out the Ayuk bonus and go with that.
So where are you leaning? Because you just put out two very different options for the 2025 draft.
I want Tet McMillan.
Ah, at four.
Yeah, I would take him at four, but I think that there'll be an opportunity to trade back, especially if one of Hunter or Abdul Carter falls to you.
Right.
So if you get an overpay, can accrue some assets to continue to improve the team and then still get what I think is the best wide receiver in the draft in McMillan around like the 7-8 spot, then I'm good with that.
Okay. I like that. I'm in on that. I can follow that plan. I'm team trade back as well, it's almost like unless Abdul Carter is there, because I people's opinions on Travis Hunter vary. I think he'll be a good player. I don't know if he's what is he going to be elite at the NFL level? I think he's going to be good on both sides of the ball, but you also added another corner. So where does he fit into that? I don't know. I'm not as Homer honk on Travis Hunter as my guy Ted Johnson or Christian Arcand are on him. But again, there's still plenty of merit to making that decision for a guy that does, at least from an athleticism perspective, has it coming out of his ears at that point. 617-779-7937 is the phone number if you want to join the conversation on the New England Patriots. I see a couple calls lining up about Stephon Diggs. So hang on, we will get to you after Zach Coe tells you what's trending.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
Red Sox fell to 1-2 on the season last night after they fell to the Texas Rangers. 4-3 the final. Rookie Christian Campbell continued to swing a hot bat. He went 2-for-3 with a double and launched his first major league home run, which tied the game at 2. They'll look to salvage a split this afternoon when Richard Fitz takes the mound opposite former Cy Young winner Jacob DeGrom. You can hear coverage of that one right here on WEEI and across the Shaw's and Star Market, WEEI Red Sox Radio Network. Shaw's perfecting the art of fresh. That starts at 1:35 with Joe Weil on the Mass Mutual pregame show. Then Will Fleming and Will Middlebrooks will have the call of the game. First pitch at 2:35. Speaking of Christian Campbell, according to Chris Cotillo of Mass Live, the Red Sox and Campbell are, quote, deep in talks on a contract extension. Celtics beat the San Antonio Spurs last night 121-111, the final that extends their winning streak to 8. Jason Tatum led the way for the Seas with 29 points. They'll wrap up their road trip tomorrow night when they head to Memphis to take on the Grizzlies, tip-off at 8:30. Bruins fell to the Detroit Red Wings 2-1 the final last night. Morgan Geeky, the lone goal scorer for the Bruins. With that loss, the Bees' losing streak is extended to 8 as they continue to tumble down the standings. A pair of NCAA tourneys continued yesterday. Over in the men's hockey tournament, BU beat Cornell in overtime to advance to the Frozen Four. UMass fell to Western Michigan. Later today, the top-seeded Boston College Eagles will take on the University of Denver in a finals rematch from last year with a spot in the Frozen Four on the line. You can hear that one over on WEEI 850 AM, coverage starting at 6:45. Then over on the basketball side, top-seeded Florida erased a 10-point second-half deficit to defeat Texas Tech and advance to the Final Four, while another top-seed, Duke, cruised to a 20-point victory over Alabama to win their region. The Elite Eight rolls on this afternoon when Houston faces Tennessee, and then top overall seed Auburn will take on Michigan State. My name is Zach Coe, and that's what's trending on WEEI and WEEI.com. More Dan Ball coming up after this.
Dan Ball on WEEI.
Okay, the 1-0 is drilled high into center field. At the track, at the wall, gone! His first big league homer, Christian Campbell, ties it at two in Texas.
It is I, Dan Ball, professing my love and admiration for Christian Campbell, who has been a professional for 2 years, was an A-ball at a certain point last year. He went single A, double A. Zach, did he even get to triple A last year?
Yeah, he after Meyer, they ruled him out for the end of the season. They got Campbell up.
Okay. All right. So it was, but it was relatively brief at the end of the year.
Yeah, and even saying that it was his second year in professional baseball is a little bit of a stretch, too, because he was drafted and then only played for a minute. So last year was his first full season as a professional.
That's ridiculous, is what that is. And I tell you, and when you watched him make his major league debut, he finishes 1-for-4. And by the way, there are plenty of very highly paid members of the Boston Red Sox who can't even say they did as well as Christian Campbell did in his MLB debut. What jumped out to me is first at bat, you could tell that the lights were pretty bright on the young man, and that's all fine and good. But the in-game adjustments that looked like were being made on the fly by this guy from at bat number one to at bat number four when he got his first major league hit, he smoked that one too. You could tell from inning one to inning nine, he was learning and he was growing and he was adjusting. Now, with normal human beings, it usually will take weeks, months to acclimate to the major league level. For Christian Campbell, it took hours because following that, 1-for-4, single in the ninth inning, he then goes 2-for-4 in game two, two singles. And then there's yesterday, 2-for-4. He had the double later on in the game, six total bases because he hit a rocket over the left center field fence. It automatically looked like, wow, not only does this guy belong, but he is going to be something very special. Now, yes, we are three games into Christian Campbell's major league career, and the natural progression, we're still days, if not weeks, away from teams who have all sorts of video technology and next-gen stats and sabermetrics available to them. They're going to put together the book on Christian Campbell. And to Zach's point about how short his professional career has been, you can't even really go through the minor league ranks and put together a book on what the holes are in his swing, what the holes are in his game, because he went to three different levels, raked at all three of them, and showed no real weaknesses to speak of. So you're going to watch Campbell probably continue to dominate for a couple of weeks, and then he's going to go through his first slump because teams are going to figure out that, oh, you know, if you throw a slider low and away like you did to Xander Bogaerts, he swings and misses every time for a strikeout, or if you buzz him up and in with fastballs, you're going to discover he has a couple of things in his arsenal that he's going to need to work on. But what gives me so much hope is that from inning one to inning nine in game one, and then from inning one of his first game to inning nine of his third game, he's already learning. He's already acclimating to, this is what I need to do in this situation. This is when I can be more aggressive. This is when I can be selective, take pitches. And I am endlessly, this is the coldest take that you'll hear on WEEI all day, but I am endlessly impressive with the way that it seems like Campbell sees the game, understands the game, and has been learning on the fly how to be successful at the major league level. And then you get the news that Christian Campbell and the Red Sox are in quote-unquote deep talks on a contract extension per Chris Cotillo, which is not something that I expected to see come across my timeline yesterday, but is nonetheless a little bit of a ray of sunshine in what was another rough effort from some of your most highly paid stars, and we'll get to that in our next Red Sox segment. But at least through three games, this guy is a dynamo. And I'll tell you, and you'll get more of this on Red Sox pregame coverage, which begins at 1:35 with my man Joe Weil, who's going to jump in for the final segment of our show to just kind of ease you into the pregame festivities a little bit. The responsibilities of Christian Campbell continue to grow because in today's lineup, it is Jaron Duran in left. Rafael Devers is your DH today, hitting second. thought there might be a little mental break from a man, but that is not the case. Then Bregman Casas. Oh, Christian Campbell back at second base in the five spot. So he slots in for Trevor Story, who has the day off. It was mentioned a couple days ago that David Hamilton was going to start on Saturday and Sunday. He starts at second base yesterday. They throw Christian Campbell out left, and now Campbell back at second. It's Willy Abreu hitting sixth and right, then Connor Wong, David Hamilton, and Seydon Rafaela back in center round out your starting nine. So Campbell has been a great highlight to start the season for the Red Sox, and quite honestly, he's kept them in ballgames. Especially yesterday, he was dragging that poor, sorry bunch of hitters along by their bootstraps as much as he possibly could for a guy playing, and again, his third career game. So endlessly impressed by him, and endlessly impressed and kind of at peace with the 10 innings, 4 hits, no runs, 1 walk, and 6 strikeouts put together by the bullpen after 3 games, because your rotation, which we'll get to, has been very ho-hum through 3 games. And unfortunately, it's the 3 guys that you actually had penciled in to be major league starters are the ones that put up some very average performances in your first trip through the rotation. But the bullpen, by and large, you put them into 2 different situations through 3 games, and they've been successful in both. You gave them the first opportunity to close out a victory, or to at least keep a game tied and allow your offense to grab the lead and then close out a victory. And they did that. You put Aroldis Chapman in the 8th inning to handle the meat of the Texas lineup. He handles that. Willy Abreu goes nuclear in that 9th inning, and then you end up getting the save from Justin Slayton. So you see the sans Liam Hendricks plan at the back end of the bullpen work to perfection in that first game. And then in the next 2 games, you get starts from Tanner Houck and Walker Buehler, respectively. And your bullpen for 2 straight games keeps you in the game and gives your sorry bunch of players on offense, your sorry bunch of hitters, a chance to try to claw back and make it a game. So of the 3 elements of the Red Sox going into the 2025 season, your offense, your starting pitching, and your rotation. I guess there's 4 with fielding, but you haven't really had any issues. By the way, Zach, that near-diving play by Campbell in left field, son of a gun. That is one of the best near catches I've ever seen.
I feel like that should be a catch, too. Like, I know it is.
Because it was in and out? Yeah.
But, like, similar to how the ground can't cause a fumble, I feel like if you hit the ground that hard and you have the ball, then it should be an out. But to even get a glove on a play like that is ridiculous.
100%.
For a second baseman.
Right, exactly. And that's the thing. I saw him in left field yesterday in the starting lineup. I'm like, damn it, guys. He just got comfortable at second base, and now you're screwing around with him. And I worry, because I've seen the Red Sox screw around with prospects in the past, and I'll cite the most recent example last year, which was Rafaela, where they played him in center, then they played him at short, then they played him at center, then they played him at short. And he had, I think he had a fine year offensively for what he was being asked to do defensively. But when a guy shows as much promise as Christian Campbell has, and a guy has so little professional experience at second base, I saw him out in left field in game 3. I'm like, guys, come on. Please, for the love of God, don't overemphasize versatility and at the expense of this guy getting comfortable and getting into a groove as a rookie. Then come to find out, Rob Refsnyder was sick. He was unavailable yesterday, so that's why, according to Alex Cora, he didn't pinch hit, which is a shame, because you would have loved to see him in righty-lefty late in the game with runners on base, but he wasn't available. Maybe that was part of the decision. Then I saw Christian Campbell make that play and also hit a home run and also hit a double, and I went, oh, I was worrying for nothing. Thank the Lord. So I hope that's not a regular occurrence, but he handled it extremely well, as he continues to do. So all that to say, the bullpen was another highlight for sure, keeping your team in games. And that was the point that I was making, where of the, let's call it 4 elements: starting pitching, bullpen, offense, defense. offense with the addition of Alex Bregman and the return of Trevor Story and the return of Tristan Casas and the, you know, the continued growth of Saydon Rafaela, it seemed as though 1-9, you were deeper than you've been in a couple of years. And through three games, you've been wildly inconsistent. And the number that we'll break down a little bit more, 1-12 with runners in scoring position yesterday, and then 6-29 overall in the series. Not good enough, because a lot of those at-bats run through your biggest stars. So top of the lineup has been inconsistent. Bottom of the lineup's been carrying you for the most part. But offense has been a major question mark to this point. Your starting pitching, a little too average for my taste. But again, first trip through the rotation, okay, fine, I'll give you that. Bullpen, which I thought was the biggest weakness on this group when it came to the structure of it. Not necessarily the arms. I liked a lot of what you had. Healthy Garrett Whitlock is an extremely dynamic reliever. Justin Slayton, a guy who showed patches of pure dominance last season. Your lefties with Chapman and Bernardino and Wilson, so you were very well set up on the left, but you just didn't have, in my mind, a closer that kind of reset the ranking of the bridge to the end of the ball game. So if you're putting Chapman in the ninth, and you're putting Slayton in the eighth, but do you have another option if you're in a high leverage situation and Slayton is down that day or doesn't have his A stuff? I thought you didn't have the high leverage guy to anchor the bullpen, and so far through three games, I'm very happy to be wrong on that front. I'm also disappointed to be wrong to this point about the way that the offense has performed. And that's what we're going to talk about on the other side, is the offense and Rafael Devers. And I mentioned it. Devers is in the lineup today. And the prevailing thought yesterday was, you got to get this guy as far away from a batter's box as possible with Jacob deGrom on the mound. I know it's righty-lefty, and these guys are just, they abide by every single lefty-righty matchup because of the slight statistical advantage that you seem to get, even though you were platooning Willier Abreu and Masataka Yoshida for no good reason last year. I digress, and I say, with a guy with electric stuff when he's healthy, like Jacob deGrom, the prevailing thought was that Devers would not play. That is not the case. We will talk about the curious case of the Red Sox DH and some of the other question marks floating around this group on the other side. Plus, we'll take your calls at 617-779-7937. How worried are you about Rafael Devers right now? Is this a blip on the radar and a cold start to a season? Or does this tie into what has been a very tumultuous spring for the now former Red Sox third baseman? We'll talk about all that and more next.
Dan Ball on WEEI.
2-2. Here it is. Casas swings and misses. He is gone, and the Red Sox will lose here in Texas. 4-3 Rangers. Sox had a ton of chances and just did not cash them in. Christian Campbell hits his first big league home run on the day that Walker Buehler made his Sox debut, but one run shy of a win in Arlington.
That was the voice of Will Fleming right here on the WEEI Red Sox Radio Network. The Wills, the Dueling Wills, will have the call again in just about an hour or two. Pre-game coverage at 1:35, first pitch 2:35, game 4, Red Sox and the Rangers. My man Joe Weil will have you covered on the pregame show. He's going to jump in today with me at about 1:20 or so after Zach's final trending, just to discuss the game and get us set for pregame coverage, to get us set for game 4 of a Red Sox-Rangers series, and a game 4 that will feature Rafael Devers. Devers went 0-4 with 3 strikeouts last night. His 10 strikeouts are the most in MLB history through the first 3 games of a season. That went hyper viral within the baseball space after that was put out yesterday. And I believe Lou Maloney said on the television side yesterday that extending back to the end of 2024, that's 6 straight games for Devers with 3 or more strikeouts. So again, last year, he clearly, his shoulder was hanging on by a thread. So last year, you could blame injury for what was going on with him, and why, you know, coming up to the month of August, he was on a career pace, especially from a power perspective. I don't know what the number was going to be, but he at least had high 30s, if not 40 home runs in his sights before the shoulder just started nagging at a level that he could not handle. And to his credit, as the Red Sox were continuing to scrap and claw for one of those final wild card spots around the trade deadline and beyond, he did continue to play and try to play through it. Unfortunately, he was just a shell of himself by that point. And the Red Sox productivity as an offense took a downturn as a direct result. So that was last year. What on God's green earth is the excuse this year? Well, you could say he didn't play in spring training. All he did was hit on the backfields and simulated at-bats against some of the Red Sox pitchers until the very end of the spring, and then his debut was pushed back and pushed back and pushed back and pushed back, and so he didn't really play that much in the spring. Okay, I will counter that by saying neither did Willier Abreu, and skinny Willier is one of the hottest players on the planet. Willier so far this season, single, home run, walk, home run, walk, single, single, out, double, out, out. That translates to a .667 batting average and a .1444 OPS. So Willier didn't play, had a gastrointestinal issue, poor guy, lost a bunch of weight, came in, and he was ready to go. So what is it with Raffy? Is he not prepared for the season, or is he not healthy? Neither are acceptable for the player, but neither are acceptable for the team. If there was any semblance that Devers was not 100% healthy, then why did he break camp with the team? Why did he play in spring training at all if he wasn't healthy? And why was the plan during the offseason just, oh, he's going to rehab it and he's going to come back and he's going to be better than ever. He'll be fine come opening day. All these elements aren't adding up to me with this player. So if he's not healthy, that's one thing. But the other and far more frustrating side of this is, what if he is healthy and he's just not locked in? He spent an entire spring speaking to the media through a translator about, I'm the third baseman, I'm playing third base. And then eventually Alex Cora put the hammer down and said, no, you're our designated hitter. And said time and again that we've had conversations in private about this player, and we have expressed and he has expressed that though he is prideful about playing third base, his biggest priority is, well, I want to see the team win, and that's what's most important to me. So if that's the case, why have you then struck out 10 times in 3 games? Like, what? Neither one of these sides are okay. If you're hurt, go on the injured list and get the hell out of my lineup. But if you're not hurt and you're not locked in, then what are we doing? You're here for 9 more years. So I'm going to have to sit here and watch this slop. I know it's 3 games. I understand that this is an overreaction. If it was 1 game, fine. If it was 2 games, oh, that's tough. 3 games? And these aren't just bases empty in meaningless at-bats. These are multiple at-bats with runners in scoring position where you're just swinging through high fastball after high fastball. I am stunned that Devers is playing today. I am absolutely stunned. I thought it was a foregone conclusion that you get this guy off his feet for a day. Give him a day, travel him to Baltimore, play him on Monday. I thought a mental reset would have been the right thing to do. And the reason I say that is statistics aside, if you heard from him after the second game, and he spoke to the media, and he was still same happy-go-lucky, like he still had a smile on his face. He was not bothered by what was going on. Yesterday, the entire dugout emptied out after the Red Sox loss, except for Devers. He was sitting in the dugout by himself, with his bat right next to him, just staring off into space, onto the field on which he struck out 3 times and 10 times total this weekend. So whatever happy-go-lucky guy that you had after game 1 and game 2 was gone after game 3. So the prevailing thought is, let him work through it. And I guess I guess I'll have to trust Alex Cora, who, again, is going to forget more about baseball and the Red Sox and his players than I will ever know. So I want to qualify that point by saying that, again, questioning the manager of the Boston Red Sox is something that it's part of the job description of being a radio host. But again, it's not something that I'm overly qualified to do. But you're going to run him back as the DH in the two spot again against Jacob DeGrom. And that's your answer for a guy who was struck out at a historic rate through three games. Zach, am I overreacting to this?
I don't think so, because the bats have been mostly non-competitive, and we know that last year he wanted to work on getting the bat to the fastballs up because he was really just getting killed in a similar way that we're seeing him get crushed now, where he's just chasing fastballs up and not able to get the barrel to it. And right now the Sox are fifth in the league in strikeouts with 31, which has been a consistent problem for them over the last really 3 or 4 years. But Devers accounts for 33% of those strikeouts at this point, and ultimately, I think he's going to be okay, but for all the drama and nonsense surrounding him in spring training, for him to come out and set a record for most strikeouts in three games is certainly not what you want.
No question about that. Well put. And I'm surprised, given the stark contrast between the top of the lineup and the bottom of the lineup through three games, I'm surprised that there wasn't some kind of tweak, even if it's just for a game. Put him down in the 5-hole, 6-hole, whatever else, and just hopefully get him into a situation where he can be in more competitive at bats, get better pitches to hit. I'm a little surprised. I'm just quite frankly a little surprised that this is the plan. We'll continue this conversation, catching up on some text for a moment regarding Devers. Oh, it's only one game. It's only two games. It's only three games. How many games does he get before the Red Sox put him on the DL for his shoulder? Time to bring the kid up now. That's a bit more serious compared to the next response from the 781. I have a solution for Devers. Someone slips him the neurovirus. Oh, good Lord. How about from the 480, he's perfectly healthy. He's not happy, so he's pouting. Unfortunately, that's what I take away as well. Let's try to get to some calls here before we get to our commercial break. My man Matt is in Rhode Island. Matt, good to hear from you, man. How are you?
Hey, what's up? Now, no doubt it's been a rough spring training and a really rough start to the year for Devers, but you just brought up an interesting point because I think, and Corey's going to give him a little slack, and I'm going to give him a tiny bit of slack because he did play hurt last year. And I just want to bring everyone's attention again that Trevor Story was collecting those big checks down in Worcester, and he was in no rush to get to the big club, which is why after Marcelo Mayer put on that clinic, I believe he should be playing over Story. But when you get that big contract, you let Devers go today. He's gonna hit his way out of this. Thanks.
Okay. All right. I like the optimism, Matt. I really do. And I obviously the skill is in there, but some kind of reset needs to happen here. I don't know if it's a physical reset because he's hurt or if it's a mental reset because he's just not locked in. But there needs to be some kind of dictation that this isn't okay. It's not acceptable as a guy who's going to be a $300 million man. And this is the supposed response to, hey, you're our DH. Your focus is completely on hitting. I see the calls continue to line up with Rafael Devers. We'll continue the Devers conversation. We do have a couple bills we need to pay, so we're going to do that very quickly. I see a lineup. There's a couple lines to get to here. If you want to jump in on the Devers conversation again, pregame coverage for the Red Sox at 1:35 today with first pitch at 2:35. More Rafael Devers talk plus your calls at 617-779-7937 to call and to text. We'll rip through some Devers calls on the other side of this here on WEEI.
This is Dan Ball on WEEI.
Three-run deficit in the seventh. The pitch. Swing and a miss. He got him. Blew him away with a fastball. And Devers is 0-for-8 with 7 strikeouts to start the season. And now it falls to Alex Bregman.
I hate to blow your mind, but it got even worse after that call from Will Fleming talking about the many, many hat tricks worth of strikeouts for Rafael Devers. Therapy session. Time is now fans of the Red Sox and Rafael Devers. Join us at 617-779-7937. Let's begin with Ryan in Leominster. Ryan, how are you, man?
Hey, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good. So we actually just came back. We're down in Globe Life. Beautiful ballpark, by the way.
Oh, but no kidding.
I just want to touch on, it's like, yeah, Rafi, body language was good, everything. But when I was on the plane last night watching the coverage, I think it was Maloney who touched on it. He goes, it looks mechanical. His front shoulder dipping. They said he's done this in, like, different, like, when he's had a cold streak. It's like, hey, go back, look at the mechanics. I don't think rolling him out today against DeGrom, maybe not the best idea. But, I mean, worse scenario, he ain't hitting the ball. Give him one of the Yankee fungo bats at this point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point, Ryan. Thank you for the call. And I want to hit on that, and we'll do that in just a moment. But Zach was mentioning that during the break, so I have to give credit where credit is due. He was talking about the same idea. Actually, why am I going to paraphrase this? Zach, what was your takeaway about the hand placement, the shoulder placement, things like that?
Yeah, I haven't gone back and looked at the film to see if this is actually it, but yeah. Last year when he was chasing too many fastballs up, Cora said that the big adjustment he was making was that he wanted his hands to start lower so he can get to that fastball up quicker.
Right.
So my first thought is maybe if he's chasing that and not getting the barrel of the bat there, that he's moved his hands back to where it was 2 years ago,
yeah.
And we're seeing that same problem arise again.
Okay, well put. And well said from a guy that knows ball. And again, when a lot of this conversation goes around the mentality of Rafael Devers and the fact that when you strike out, then you sit there for a couple innings and you think about the strikeout. Then when you get back in the box, you try to make up for the strikeout that you just had. So it's a snowballing effect of as you strike out more, the swings become more desperate. You're trying to jack the ball up more. And the natural progression is you're trying to hit the ball farther, which leads you to uppercut. So when pitchers understand that, you already have a propensity to chase the high fastball. If you're trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark, they're going to throw it high. You're going to uppercut. You're going to miss those pitches. So it does. It's a mechanical result that comes from a mental beginning, if that makes sense. It's the struggles that come from the strikeouts early on in the season from a bad first game that snowballs into a worse second game, a worse third game, and it really can result in the devolving of mechanics for a hitter to I am just trying to do whatever I can to get a bat on the ball, because if I hit one to Narnia, then it's going to solve all of my problems that I've had with my strikeouts. But we'll continue the conversation. 617-779-7937. Wally is in Fall River. Good afternoon, Wally. How are you?
Yeah, what's up, guys? I mean, you look at it at Rafi's, it's brutal. It hurts your eyes to watch him swing
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
It really does. But I don't know what the answer is, but he's making a lot of money, guys. Making a lot of money. He's not punching the clock and making $25 an hour. He's our Reggie Jackson. Him and Bregman, they're the ones that have got a straw that stirs the drink. But I wonder what's going to happen down the road. We got him for a long time. And, you know, he's going to produce. He's in that lineup to hit 30 home runs and knock in 90 runs. But as far as the Red Sox, I think the Red Sox were lucky yesterday. Campbell didn't get hit on that play. Imagine if he would have separated his shoulder or
yeah.
something. So I think we were very lucky. But we're going to have to see what happens. I just don't think he can handle a DH role mentally. He's just not equipped for it. I think they mentioned that much, Michael Holly. He's, you know, we got to coddle him. How do you coddle somebody making $300,000? Yeah, I mean, his contract, you know, he's not making peanuts. But yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with him down the road.
Yeah, no question, Wally. Thank you. Thank you for the call. And to the point of, well, he can't handle being a DH, too damn bad. You're going to have to figure this out. And the reason I say that is because you've already illustrated that he is not good enough to be your third baseman. And so you're probably not going to goat another team to trade for a $300 million designated hitter who was the, statistically speaking, worst infielder in terms of defensive runs saved and how much they cost their team since he made his debut in 2017. So you're not going to get somebody to trade for this contract at this point with the kind of performance that you're getting. And you've already said that you can't trust him at third base, and you have Marcelo Meyer waiting in the wings, and you have Alex Bregman for what is probably going to be all 3 years of that contract. He's making $40 million. I wouldn't go anywhere if I was him, given what the market would probably be. So your one option and your only option right now at this current point in time is figure out how to get this guy to hit. The text from the 978 says, well, have Ortiz talk and help Devers. Okay, that's a start. And Zach was mentioning this during the break, that he acknowledged that he hasn't talked to David Ortiz or JD Martinez, and he's going to do that with both of them. They can talk until they're blue in the face, but it's a mentality that Ortiz had in that he developed and became very good at. It's a mentality that JD Martinez had and became very good at, being students of the game of hitting a baseball, where instead of striking out and sitting there for two or three innings and thinking about what you could have done better and, you know, going and writing on the chalkboard 100 times, I will not strike out again, I will not strike out again. They went down, they took some swings in the cage, they watched the video. And again, not the sign-stealing video, Astros, the real video. Watched on the iPad, watch whatever you can. They learned, they grew, they came back better hitters their next at-bat than their previous at-bat, and they became students of the game. Instead of taking infield, outfield, instead of fielding ground balls or fly balls or whatever else, it was all about, from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed, I am figuring out the best way to hit this baseball. And maybe that's more embodied by Martinez than Ortiz, who was just an otherworldly hitter. But again, these guys committed to the craft. I am being told by my team that in Ortiz's case, I'm not good enough to be a first baseman. In JD Martinez's case, I'm not spry enough to be an outfielder. But I still want to win, and I want to make the most of my career. So I am going to just be twice as good of a hitter to make up for the fact that I am not a good enough fielder to play in the field for the Boston Red Sox. And the question that has to be answered, that I don't think we have an answer to yet, or at least not an answer that fans want to hear, is Rafael Devers mentally capable of making that adjustment in his game at this point in his career with a lot of runway left for a guy that should just be getting into his prime? And there is no evidence to me right now to point to the positive that he can handle that. And you're going to have to find a way to get through to him. I know Alex Cora is the Devers whisperer. He's one of the very few guys. He, JD Martinez, and Xander Bogaerts are really the three guys that get the most credit for being able to speak to Devers in a way that he understands, appreciates, and helps him be productive in the games and weeks moving forward. You don't have Bogaerts. Martinez is kind of quietly still out there. He doesn't have a job right now. So I'm throwing out an idea. Would you give a one-year contract to JD Martinez just to sit there and coach Devers and be a bat coming off the bench? I don't know. What's it going to take? This guy makes $300 million. You have to make something out of this investment, because he's not going anywhere, and you're not going to trick a team stupid enough with the money to pay this guy to be a bad third baseman for them at this current moment. So you have to find a way to figure it out. Okay, diatribe over. Frank is in Falmouth. Good afternoon, Frank. How are you?
Dan Ball.
What's up?
Great to talk to you. Congrats on the WEA gig.
Thank you, sir.
You're doing an awesome job.
Thank you.
No problem. Hey, I'm totally 100% on board with your assessment of Devers. I mean, it's really mind over matter with him. I just think his mental outlook here is overtaking his skill and ability. So I really think that's where the Sox have to start first, is getting him his head in the game and getting over the fact that he's not a third baseman any longer, and get his act together to help this team win, because they have the talent and the skill set to do that. So,
hey, well put, Frank. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. And that's the one question that you have to find a way to answer. And to this point, as you know, what we know on the 30th of March, 2025, at 1:13 p.m., what we know is Alex Cora's best assessment of this situation is that running him back out there for another game in this situation is the best way to try to get him right. And it could legitimately take one swing of the bat for him to fix all of this. And I think that's kind of what Cora is banking on. You have him. He's not going anywhere. You're not putting him on the injured list. You're not trading him. You're not DFAing him. You're not doing any of those things. We just have to play him, and we have to let him figure it out. And we have to give him, as we've yanked him off a third base, we have to show that we can still provide him stability as an MLB player. And just because he's had a bad weekend to this point, we're not going to pull the plug on him and throw him in the seven hole or whatever else it ends up taking. So that is the assessment that was made by Alex Cora and the coaching staff on Rafael Devers. We can continue this conversation in just a couple of moments. If you have any final thoughts on Rafael Devers, I know we're getting closer to pregame coverage, so we're going to wrap up our proceedings here and get you into coverage of the Red Sox. And before we do that, one final call. Rick is in Salem with the last word on Devers. What's up, Rick?
Yeah, brother, listen, this is my take of it. First, A, if the shoulders were bothering him since last year, why wasn't it taken care of before spring training? B, the last 4 years of his second half numbers have been horrible. I don't like him. I think he's overrated, and I think he's on a decline. Brother, that's my take of it.
Brother, I appreciate the call. That was Rick in Salem. I understand your frustrations, guys. I really do. And I tell you what, that he is going to be featured prominently in Red Sox baseball coverage, which begins here on the WEEI Red Sox Radio Network promptly at 1:35 p.m. My man Joe Weil is two studios away talking with Joe Braverman about the Boston Red Sox and their upcoming pregame coverage. Joe is going to jump in for a quick crossover with me to talk some Sox and get ready for coverage here on a Sunday. One more word. Tony from Bridgewater sneaks in under the clock. What's up, Tony? How are you?
Hey, how are you, my friend?
I'm good.
You know, sometimes a banana is just a banana. This guy's a lazy ball player. He's always been a lazy ball player. To give him that contract on a one-tool player is ridiculous to begin with. But going forward, you got to find someone to trade with him, because everyone's talking about his hands, his shoulder, he's going up. It has nothing to do with that. It's all between the ears. And you're not going to fix that with a guy like this.
There you go. Tony, thank you for the call. Much appreciated. And our takeaway, a banana is still a banana. We'll hit a break right here and wrap up our thoughts on the Red Sox leading into pregame coverage here on WEEI. But before all of that happens, Zach Coe has to tell us what's trending.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
The Red Sox fell to 1-2 on the season last night after they lost yet again to the Texas Rangers, 4-3 the final. Christian Campbell continued to swing a hot bat. He went 2-for-3 with a double and his first major league home run, which tied the game at 2. They'll look to salvage a split this afternoon when Richard Fitz takes the mound opposite former Cy Young winner Jacob DeGrom. You can hear coverage of that one right here on WEEI and across the Shaw's and Star Market, WEEI Red Sox Radio Network. Shaw's perfecting the art of fresh, coverage starting at 1:35 with Joe Weil on the Mass Mutual pregame show. Then Will Squared, Will Fleming, and Will Middlebrooks will have the call of the game first pitch at 2:35. Speaking of Christian Campbell, according to Chris Cotillo of Mass Live, the Red Sox and Campbell are in, quote, deep talks on a contract extension. Celtics beat the San Antonio Spurs last night, 121-111 the final. That extends their winning streak to 8. Jason Tatum led the way with 29 points. They'll wrap up their road trip tomorrow night when they head to Memphis to take on the Grizzlies, tip off at 8:30. Bruins fell to the Detroit Red Wings 2-1 the final in Detroit last night. Morgan Geekie the lone goal scorer for the Bruins. With that loss, the Bees' losing streak is extended to 8 as they continue to fall further and further out of the playoff race. A pair of NCAA tourneys continued yesterday. Over in the men's hockey tournament, BU beat Cornell in overtime to advance to the Frozen Four. UMass fell to Western Michigan. Later this afternoon, the top-seeded Boston College Eagles will take on the University of Denver in a finals rematch from last year with a spot in the Frozen Four on the line. You can hear that one over on WEEI 850 AM, pregame starting at 6:45. Then over on the basketball side, Florida erased a 10-point deficit in the second half to defeat Texas Tech and advance to the Final Four, while another top seed, Duke, handled Alabama to win their region. The Elite Eight rolls on this afternoon when Houston takes on Tennessee, and then top overall seed, Auburn, faces Michigan State. My name is Zach Coe, and that's what's trending on WEEI and WEEI.com. Wrapping things up with Dan Ball coming up after this.
Dan Ball on WEEI.
Well, we are closing in on coverage of Boston Red Sox baseball. Game 4, Red Sox and the Rangers in their season opening battle down at Globe Life Field. Sox will then take on the Baltimore Orioles beginning on Monday before returning home to Fenway to open up the home slate. The dulcet tones of Joe Weil will be taking you into Boston Red Sox baseball coverage here on this Sunday, and I am lucky enough to be sitting next to Joe Weil for a couple of moments. How you doing, man?
Doing great. Glad to be on with you. Glad to be back. I know the season hasn't started the way we've hoped.
Yeah.
One lead through the first 27 innings of the year for the Sox,
God.
But at the same time, so glad to be talking baseball. So glad to be here and lots to discuss, too.
We worked together a couple times after Christmas. It did feel a little bit like we were shoehorning baseball in for the sake of having baseball conversations. I'm not regretting that we did it because it was still fun to do. But what is your perception of this Devers conversation? Because they range from he's still injured to it's a mechanical issue to it's a mental issue. It may be somewhere in the gray area between all of those, but what do you make of what seems to be the biggest story around this team?
I don't think it's a physical issue at this point. I do think the lack of at-bats during spring training has played a factor here, and his timing is just so off. And you saw it in yesterday's game, but you've really seen it all series, that the Rangers have been challenging him with the fastball. And Tyler Mahle, who pitched yesterday, he got the start for the Rangers and didn't last long. He actually walked Devers. That was the lone time he got on base.
Right.
But I was looking back at Baseball Savant, and he swung and missed on 4 fastballs. Now, Mahle, he's got one of those fastballs that sort of has some late life to it. It's got a little giddy up at the end, so
yeah.
The miles per hour doesn't stand out, but it's a tough pitch to hit. But they were just challenging him, and they've done that all series. I feel like Hobie Milner did that in the middle match, or I'm sorry, not yesterday's game, 2 games ago when he had the bases loaded.
Yep.
So he's just so late. He's just out of whack right now. I don't think that he's still hurt. I just think he's just not in sync, which you couple that with all the drama in spring training, of course we're all going to talk about it. First off, it's Boston. Everything is a big deal all the time.
Yeah.
And I understand why the fans are not happy with the way things have started out, but I do think it's in part self-inflicted. Just the way that the Red Sox have gone about this whole Devers conversation, it's hard to feel bad for somebody making over $300 million, but he is still a human being, and he was the guy that did want to stick around when Xander Bogaerts left, and then, of course, they move on from Mookie Betts as well. He wanted to be a part of this, and then you're moving him off his position. You're doing it when spring training starts as well. I just think that there's a lot of factors going on, and I think this might take some time to sort of smoothen itself out.
Let's pause on that for a moment, because this had so many different wrinkles during the offseason. It started with the report that, you know, Devers was promised third base in the Heimblum regime. So I don't fault the Breslow-Kennedy regime that has since followed for not holding true to a promise that I think is ridiculous to make for a player over that long of a contract. But what bothers me in hindsight, if you weren't completely sold on Devers at third base, there is no winning in this situation. But if you were hot on Bregman and your fallback was trading for Nolan Arenado, as in no matter what, you were trading for a better defensive third baseman than Rafael Devers, you probably should have been honest about this thing from the very beginning. And you brought on a little bit of this drama just with the way you seem to handle this thing.
And I've seen people bring it up on Twitter. You know, Alex Cora, who I'm a huge fan of. Anybody that listens to my post-game shows know I'm a huge fan of Alex Cora.
Yeah.
But he did say, you know, earlier on in the offseason that they wanted to pursue Alex Bregman as a second baseman. And
yep.
He said, Rafael Devers is our third baseman. Maybe that was just saying it at that point in time. But we all had heard him say that, okay, Alex Bregman, if they get him, will be the second baseman of this team. And then he comes into camp. You saw, I think it was the first day, you know, after they do the presser with Bregman, he's getting some reps at second base. That was really it. It was just like right at the beginning, and then they were putting him at third base. So it was a quick pivot.
Yeah.
And
it was almost like a PR stunt. We just need to put him here to live up to the fact that we've been talking about him playing here.
Right, exactly. And so from Devers' perspective, again, he's the franchise guy. I do think eventually he's going to have to mentally get there, because I do think the best version of this team is having Alex Bregman at third base, because he is a gold glove third baseman.
Yeah.
We've seen already some great defensive plays out of Christian Campbell. First game a little shaky, which he admitted early, but didn't make any mistakes.
No.
So I think the best defensive alignment is having Bregman at third, and the defense on the infield, even though they're 1-2, that's looked pretty good. And that's been a nice sight to see, especially, Dan, as somebody that's been doing pre and post over the last 2 years, and the infield defense has been awful.
Oh, my God.
And because Story's been hurt, but, I mean, it's been really bad.
Yeah.
And it's been a nice sight to see at least that part of it, you know, be good. I just think this is going to take some time to shake out.
Yeah, no question about that. But as the Devers conversation continues, while we have a couple of moments before we get into your fantastic pregame coverage, what else has jumped out to you, the good, the bad, the ugly, through three games that have seen some highlights and one that you kind of alluded to with a certain second baseman / left fielder, but what else has jumped out to you through three games?
Christian Campbell is that dude, man.
Did you think he was going to make the team out of camp?
I did.
Okay.
I did, because Alex Cora, the last couple camps, has done this thing where he's alluded to essentially wanting a player to win a job.
Yeah.
He did it with Sadon Rafaela last year. And right at the beginning of spring training, it was basically him in his own way saying, we want Christian Campbell to win this spot. And
right.
I was pro that camp because I was so impressed with what he did last year. He's an athletic freak. We've already seen it in some of the data that's come through Baseball Savant. And he's just been so much fun to watch. I was so bummed he didn't make that catch in left field, and I was listening to the Wills on the call. And Will Fleming, like we all did, thought he caught that initially, and then it came out of his glove when he hit the ground. But then to hit the home run with Will Middlebrooks calling it right before it, which...
Yeah, how about that? That's two called home runs in three games.
It's awesome. And Will Fleming is so good at that, too. So it's awesome to have that dynamic in the booth. But I've been so impressed by him. That's been my favorite positive. Him and Willy Abreu, who we have to give a shout-out to.
Yep.
Bullpen's been good. I think in terms of the negatives, Tristan Casas, 1-for-13 with 6 strikeouts. He's been hosed on some strike calls, but at the same time, you don't have ABS, so maybe you have to be a little bit more aggressive early in counts.
That's also been an issue with him just quick in years past when he has been struggling. He has a great eye, and he knows it. He's gotten a little too selective in certain points over the last few years.
Yeah, definitely. And then the runners with scoring position, they went 1-for-12 yesterday.
Yeah.
And Alex Cora said after the game, he's liked the process with this team. They just haven't come through with runs. They're 6-for-29 to start with runners in scoring position this season. So that needs to change. And hopefully it does. They will face Jacob deGrom, who is a name I kind of forgot about, Dan, even though he's a 2-time Cy Young Award winner. And maybe if you're a peak Hall of Fame guy, could be a Hall of Fame pitcher. We'll see how it shakes out.
Before we let you go and we swap seats and I bid you adieu here on this Sunday, what can you tell us about today's pregame coverage for the Boston Red Sox?
Well, we got Will Fleming coming on. He'll be joining us at 1:45. You'll hear his pregame conversation with Alex Cora. Rob Bradford talked to today's starting pitcher, Richard Fitz, who hasn't quite hit 100 on the old radar, but he is one tick away, 99 miles per hour. That's what he topped out in spring training. I'm excited to talk about Richard Fitz, Dick Fitz, here on the pregame show. It's going to be a fun matchup today with one guy that's a young guy trying to establish himself, the old guy in Jacob deGrom trying to find that that form that made him so good. Dude, I'm just so glad to be back talking baseball. It is great. And you're right. When we talked in December, that wasn't the case. We were shoehorning it in. Talk of Town.
That's right. Talk of Town indeed. Sox are back. Sox coverage coming up next year on WEEI. So keep it locked for my man Joe Weil, who will bring you up into game coverage. Game 4, Red Sox and the Rangers, 2:35 first pitch. Dickie Fitz against Jacob deGrom. That is going to do it for me here on this Sunday. Thanks for joining via call and via text. I'll be back on the updates tomorrow afternoon on WEEI Afternoons. Rain delay depending for Sox and Orioles on a Monday. Thank you to my man Zach Coe behind the glass. Have a wonderful rest of your Sunday, and Red Sox coverage is on the way next. See ya.